I'm Miles Parks. I cover voting and election security for NPR. Across the NPR network, we report rigorously on the forces seeking to disrupt democracy and provide communities with reliable information. It's Public Media Giving Days, the perfect time to stand with the facts by donating now at donate.npr.org. Thank you.
Sometimes there's a time and place for a long movie, specifically a great movie that's more than 3 hours long.
Martin Scorsese's latest movie, Killers of the Flower Moon, clocks in at over 3 hours. We'll be reviewing it later this week, and in the meantime, we're recommending three great movies over 3 hours on this episode of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Glenn Weldon.
And I'm Linda Holmes. Whether it's because you've got an afternoon off, you're settling in for a full evening, or you just aren't in the mood to flip from one entertainment to another, we've got you covered.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beat. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part. Make sure that the NPR network stays strong by supporting us at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
Is it possible to engineer our way out of the climate crisis? Some entrepreneurs want to shoot particles into the stratosphere to combat global warming. Experts say regulations on this technology aren't keeping up. The world of solar geoengineering on the latest episode of The Sunday Story from NPR's Up First podcast.
Listen to Embedded for moments that stay with you.
I could smell the smoke. I could smell the dust.
Voices that resonate. Stories that change the way you think about your life.
How did we get here?
The Embedded podcast is NPR's home for original documentary series. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
It's just the two of us today, Glenn and I, and we have often on the show talked about movies that are too long, that feel too long. So we are here to celebrate some movies that are real super long. And Glenn, you're going to go first. You're kicking us off.
Yeah, my first pick is Magnolia, Thomas Anderson's 1999 film about, it's hard to say.
Yeah.
It's about a bunch of disparate folk in the San Fernando Valley, parents and kids disappointing each other in ways big and small. We should state here, it is a divisive movie. A lot of folks find it navel-gazy and nonsensical. The term hot mess gets tossed around a lot. I'm all for a hot mess if it's nice and savory like this one is. Basically, Jason Robards is a dying man. Philip Seymour Hoffman at peak Hoff, I would say, is his nurse. Julianne Moore is his wife. Listen to this cast. Tom Cruise is his estranged son, who's kind of a toxic men's rights guru. And April Grace is a reporter who confronts Cruise's character, and they have a lot of tense scenes between them. And at the time, I remember Cruise soaked up a lot of the attention about those scenes because he was playing a very slick guy who kind of gets confronted and collapses. And I think there's a resonance there if you are a longtime movie watcher and you see a character that you kind of can see some Tom Cruise in getting called upon and the fact that he could pull that off. But if you go back and watch that now, your eyes do not depart from April Grace, because April Grace is driving those scenes in a really big way. She's doing a fantastic job.
See, I have more important things to put myself into.
Well, no, it's all important, Frank. I think this is something very important that you might need to think about putting yourself into.
Not really.
Frank, it's not like I'm trying to attack you here.
No.
I just...
Okay, hey, this is how you want to spend your time, then go. But you're going to be surprised at what a waste it is.
There's also a thread involving John C. Reilly's cop and his determination to woo a deeply unwooable person played by Melora Walters. It's probably the weakest of the threads, I think. William H. Macy is this sad sack grown-up quiz show kid. Philip Baker Hall is this quiz show host. And the young Jeremy Blackman is a current quiz show kid. This is a very ambitious film. It's got a terrific soundtrack by Amy Mann.
Sure does.
That was inescapable in the year 2000 if you found yourself in certain circles.
Yeah.
We talk a lot on this show, Linda, about the difference between good acting and the most acting, and this movie really rides that line. It's got an ending that is profoundly unpredictable, yet I found completely, deeply satisfying. You know, I almost picked Shortcuts, Robert Altman's 1993 film, which is kind of a take on a bunch of Raymond Carver stories. That has some great acting in it, but it doesn't have this banana pants ending that brings all these stories together at such a weirdly oblique angle. This is one of those films that I have only seen once, but I have never forgotten a single frame of it. How about you?
You know how when you Google a movie, like to figure out where it's streaming or whatever, it sometimes will pop up like a list of questions that people ask about that. The very first question was, I love this so much. It was, what's the point of Magnolia? Now, there are some movies that if you Google them, you'll get like what happens at the end of Magnolia. This is not like Mulholland Drive, like where what people do is they debate like what's actually happening. It's not that. It's what's the point of Magnolia? And that's one of the things I really like about it is that its opacity is all around kind of why are we talking about these stories and why are we talking about them together?
Yeah.
I've never really reached a particularly satisfactory conclusion. But the thing that's good about it to me is it's so much fun to watch all these actors. As you said, the cast is just bonkers. And I will say, rewatching it, it is so painful watching Philip Seymour Hoffman at this moment in his career. This is 1999. He also did The Talented Mr. Ripley in this same year and then the next year, Almost Famous. And this is kind of where he's really growing into that like super actor. And I watched it and it made me grieve all over again for the literally decades of performances that I feel like were lost when he died young.
Absolutely. He went to Paul Thomas Anderson and said, I want to play a guileless good person, which you would think is actor death, right?
Yeah.
But he does, and he brings so much to a role that doesn't necessarily on the surface have a lot to it, but there is such depth.
Yeah, I think it's just an opportunity to appreciate him all over again. It's a great pick. This movie doesn't feel long to me, even though it is so very long. People think that I am not an art house movie person, but this is a very artsy movie, and I'm very into it. But I will say my pick for my 3-hour movie, I went with the Linda is a Basic. And especially, I did want to talk about how, in addition to very artsy movies that can get away with being that long, it is possible to make a pop project that can get away with being that long. And so I am talking about Avengers Endgame from 2019. I really found the end of this saga very satisfying. The film is just a minute or two over 3 hours. And when you go back and look at it, you see that it's structured in such an unusual way. And that's part of why it's so long. It is very much chaptered. It has a whole opening 20 minutes or so that's about this failed attempt to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. It has a section that's about actually solving the problem. And there's so much for this movie to do. At the end of the previous film, you know, you had had this catastrophe happen to the world. And there's sort of, you got to undo that. I mean, you got to fix the catastrophe. Mm-hmm. You got to resolve the ultimate fight between goodies and baddies. And they also had to put some kind of conclusion on a whole bunch of different stories that they had spent, you know, 10 plus years telling in a whole bunch of movies. And if you think about everything that they had to do, it does make some sense that it's 3 hours long. I get completely lost in all of the time travel and all of the quantum realm. I know there are people out there who understand the whole thing and could explain it to me. Please don't. It doesn't matter. Because what I love about this movie and have always loved about the MCU movies that I do like is the individual pieces are fun to watch. Mm-hmm. They made what I think was a pretty surprising decision to center Paul Rudd in large chunks of this movie as Ant-Man, which was, given that it was an Avengers movie, maybe not the expected move. Mm-hmm. And then also you have, you know, really funny bits like the Captain America fighting himself is one of my favorite things in any MCU movie. Mm-hmm. So even though it's 3 hours long, I think it gets away with it because the individual pieces, you know, both the story has multiple chapters and then the individual scenes to me are very pleasurable.
Right. I mean, this does feel like what it had to feel like, which is the culmination of something, not just the story set up in Infinity War, but everything that came before it, as you said. It's tough to pull off, but like that's a lot of plates to spin. Mm-hmm. And some of those plates, I think we'll agree, got a little wobbly. The Black Widow thread is a notable plate crashing. But as a communal experience, that final battle, which is famously where most Marvel movies kind of descend into muddiness and incoherence, had so many moments when the audience erupted into cheers. this is a movie where it's a fundamentally different experience to watch that film at home than it was to see it in the theater. The experience can't be compared, and that's what you paid for. That's the theater-going experience.
You know, I've seen it a few times. I do rewatch these movies occasionally, especially since you can find them on Disney Plus, and especially since you can fast-forward through the parts that you do think are boring, Fat Thor being one of mine. But I have rewatched it, and I will tell you, I tune out so much to these big movies in those battle sequences, typically that last, like, half hour, 20 minutes, half hour. This one, I tear up multiple times during that final sequence. I tear up when the people who were zapped start to come back. I tear up when the hammer happens. Yep. I tear up and tear up and tear up, and I love the whole thing. And I will say, you know, on the topic of bloat, and the fact that we talk so much about movies that are too long, I'm less bothered by movies that are 3 hours long than I am by movies that should be 2 hours long or an hour and 45 minutes long that are 2.5 hours long.
Right.
Because I do feel like there's a thing now where anything that you go to that takes itself at all seriously is going to be at least 2.5 hours long. That's where the bloat is, not necessarily the ones that come out at 3 hours.
Yeah. I mean, what we're talking about is films that justify their length. And in various ways, the films we talked about and are talking about do that.
Yeah. Well, you have one more pick. And I have to say, it helps give lie to the idea that the 3 hour movie has just recently, even in the last 20 years, become something people can pull off. What's your second pick?
Well, I mean, you know, you said the Endgame pick was basic. This is in many ways an even more basic pick because my second pick is Seven Samurai, Akira Kurosawa's 1954 epic. He co-wrote it, he edited it, he directed it. Most critics certainly will probably put this film in their top 10 of all time, but there's a reason for that. It's about a village that hires seven ronin to protect themselves against bandits who are going to be coming to steal their crops. But this is an example of a film that's not really about the plot. It's all about the execution. The extra running time allows a depth of characterization, the way these very radically different styles of acting, by the way, kind of define these different characters. And of course, those epic sweeping battle sequences. And this film inspired so many later films, from The Magnificent Seven, which is basically a remake of, to Star Wars and beyond. But that's only the premise. That's only the subject. What you notice, if you keep an eye out for it, is the technique, the framing of shots, the editing. You can see it everywhere. The battle scenes in Lord of the Rings, the battle scenes in Game of Thrones, I can make an argument that the Endgame battle scenes all go through this film. They wouldn't have happened without this film. It's kind of tricky to watch films like this that have inspired subsequent filmmakers, because sometimes you watch a really influential film, and this is the postmodern condition, right, where you watch the thing that's riffing on the thing before you see the actual thing.
Right.
And then when you see it finally, you're like, oh, I see how directors have picked up on this and innovated in some way, made it new. So seeing this OG version is like, oh, I see where they got that from. And that's the extent of it. But here, there is so much. The length of this film isn't superfluous or indulgent, because this film takes place over the course of a year, and we track this village over the course of a year because it is a farming village. And watching them plant and tend and sow these crops that they care so deeply about, we see how much work it is, we see how important it is, and then what Kurosawa was dedicated to doing was exploring how close the samurai and the bandits are, and how violence begets violence. And he was really admitting some nuance into this giant picture. And sometimes that arrives in a very outsized way. I mean, the performance of Toshiro Mifune, for example, might seem too modernized, very outsized, very theatrical, but it's part of the mix that works. And seeing that, you are reminded that directing is this weird mix. It's artistic vision meets these punishingly mundane logistics. I'll just getting everybody on screen and getting everybody to kind of hit their marks. And this is one of those classic films that I think sits on the cinematic equivalent of like your bedside table forever. You always mean to get to it, but you're worried that it's going to feel like homework. It's not. This film is a revelation.
As much as we talk about movies that are too long, and we have absolutely done that, it's all relative to how much you justify it. It's all relative to how much story you have and how much character development you have. But also, it's relative to how much pleasure in the individual moments of, and the scenes of those films, that makes it very easy for me to digest that at 3 hours.
Sure.
Well, we want to know, what are your favorite movies that are over 3 hours? Find us at facebook.com/PCHH. And that brings us to the end of our show. Glenn Weldon, thank you so much for doing this with me.
As always.
This episode is produced by Mike Katziff and Thomas Liu and edited by Jessica Reedy. And Hello Come In provides our theme music. Thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. I'm Linda Holmes, and we'll see you all tomorrow.
Hey, I hear you have a birthday coming up. Yeah, you. If you're listening to this, that means you have a birthday coming up eventually. And here at Life Kit, we want it to be a special one.
Magic can happen and good luck can happen and serendipity can happen if we're open to it.
How to have a good birthday, even if you're not a birthday person. That's on the Life Kit podcast from NPR.
Do you ever wish you could get your stories in 3 hours rather than 3 minutes? Or maybe you're sick of doom scrolling, getting your news in bits and pieces. That is where Embedded comes in. We bring you documentary series that will change the way you think about things. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.